This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Gabrielle Calvo-Caressi has become more or less comfortable with viewing the world through the prisms of sex or gender. On a day-to-day basis, the poet encourages people to just use the name Gabrielle or Gabby instead of she or her. By exploring a genderless and sexless world it's a little bit trickier in writing than just an ideology. So Gabby worked with editors to come up with a new option, a musical symbol called Dalsengo, which looks like a lopsided S with a line through it, got a couple of dots. And in this new poetry collection, Rocket Fantastic, Gabby uses the symbol to stand for some personal pronouns to allow readers to engage with the content while leaving sex and gender as an open question. The collection explores the lives of people and animals whose individual experiences may seem small, but when taken together, they explore big questions about violence, grief, nature, and familial relationships. Gabrielle is an award-winning poet and essayist, also a professor of English, and the Walker Percy Fellow in Poetry at UNC Chapel Hill, and here with me on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Let's start by talking a bit about your use of this symbol, which I think is Dalsengo, or perhaps Dalsenyo.
Yeah, Dalsenyo, I think. Yeah, Dalsenyo.
Yeah. Yeah. An Italian term, so it's got to be about music.
Right, absolutely.
but in any event, it's the thing you've come to. You don't use it in all of your poetry, so there are personal pronouns here.
Absolutely, and it really, in this book, in my second book, I made a choice to try and have as few personal pronouns as possible that were gendered. And then in this book that is really, thinking about what is the vessel we make for ourselves and how can that vessel shift? How do borders shift all the time? Some of the poems really worked with voices that were comfortable identifying themselves, placing themselves in a specific vessel, she, he. And then there were these poems that I think in many ways helped me deal with my own relationship to my gender as I grew up and continue to grow. And those poems seemed most interested in not finding a vessel for themselves, that kind of act of unknowing as the vessel itself.
Describe that relationship with us, because I think it helps inform the poetry and the way in which you inquire, you interrogate these questions.
Yeah. Perhaps I'll deal with it a little bit on sort of a personal level, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think, like many people, my sense of my gender and of my sex has really shifted throughout my life. I think this is actually, when I go on the road, and I'm on the road a lot right now, this is something that people from all walks of life come and talk to me about. People, I understand. I'm not sure how I would identify myself. This symbol really speaks to both the child I was, who until I was around 8 years old, identified very much as a boy. And then moving into my own queer identity, my own lesbian identity, sort of shifting into what does it mean to think about myself as a woman who desires women? Am I a woman? This kind of unknowing became something that was very important to me, particularly, I think, in a moment where it sort of feels like we're supposed to know everything.
Well, it's interesting to use that term, unknowing.
Yeah.
And I'll have this conversation with a poet because I wouldn't dare with anyone else. To unknow is to do two things. It's to not know.
Right.
But it also means to dislearn, right? It's to take apart what you think you already knew.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of perpetual beginner's mind. Mm-hmm. But also, right, like the mastery of not knowing. I mean, and that can be a really extraordinary thing. It's November 7th today, and sort of thinking about what are the things in this world that I know and what are the things that I don't know, and how might my willingness to say, gosh, I don't know, I need to keep exploring this, help me make a more interesting artistic world, but perhaps a more interesting and compassionate world in general for myself.
Well, let's get it. Can I get a sample of your poetry now? Will you read for us?
Sure.
Tell us a little bit.
This
about
poem
it.
Is called She Ties My Bow Tie. What you thought was the sound of the deer drinking at the base of the ravine was not their soft tongues entering the water, but my love tying my bow tie. We were in our little house just up from the ravine. Forgive yourself. It's easy to mistake her wrists for the necks of deer. Her fingers move so deftly, one could call them skittish, though not really, because they aren't afraid of you. I know. You thought it was the deer, but they're so far down you couldn't possibly hear them. No, this is the breeze my love makes when she ties me up and sends me out into the world. Her breath pulled taut and held until she's through. I watch her in the mirror, not even looking at me. She's so focused on the knot and how to loop the silk into a bow.
That's poet Gabrielle Calva-Caressi reading from a new collection of poetry, Rocket Fantastic. Gabby's a professor of English and poetry and a fellow at UNC Chapel Hill. Among the many things I love about that poem is how sensuous it is. I mean, it's sexy.
Thank you.
It is beautiful, and it really is at once erotic and then pedestrian. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we're tying a bow tie.
Yeah.
You know?
Which, I mean, I wear a bow tie every day.
Yeah.
I wear it to teach in, and it's a hard thing to do to
yes.
tie a bow tie.
yeah.
You should go on YouTube and look at Mr. Charles. He'll teach you how to do it without needing to look in the mirror. But it's also an interesting thing. About 2 years ago, I just made the decision I was going to start wearing a bow tie. It was something I'd always wanted to do. And yet it was a kind of, admission of, I don't know if it's masculinity or something else, that I was nervous about. Could I do that in the classroom? Could I do that? So the kind of freedom in doing that and the pleasure in doing it, the conversations I have at the airport because of it, all over the world. The poem has sensual pleasure, which is erotic, but also just like what it is to be yourself in the everyday world.
In the everyday world. So that one, that is going to bring me to my next set of questions here, which really involve this question that you raised earlier, this beginner's mind.
Yeah.
The idea that if we really want to figure out who we are, first we have to forget who we were told we are and who we thought we are. But there has to be some container. There has to be some vessel. Otherwise, we fall into these solipsisms and it becomes utterly ethereal. It's groundless. I mean, there is no better definition than the bow tie to define the border between, you know, neck and torso,
yes,
head and torso,
absolutely.
Right? On the other hand, this poem brings us into much larger questions about who we are.
Yes.
Is this something you wrestle? I mean, do you have, let me ask the question this way. Do you have a spiritual life that informs some of this?
Oh, absolutely. And for instance, this past weekend, I was just at Brown University with the poet Janine Lentine and Sensei Koshin Paley Ellison, who started the New York Zen Center's contemplative care program. And so we spent 2 whole days talking about poetry and poetics, but also contemplative life and doing, you know, sits, zazen. So it's a big part of my life, sort of this spiritual world that I inhabit, which is based on questioning, right? What is out there? What does it mean to ask what is out there? But how do you do that in a way that is grounded and you know, also has to do with getting the groceries and, you know, getting on the bus, voting?
Can I ask you to read another poem for us?
Sure, absolutely. This poem is called I Was Popular in Certain Circles. And I should say the title is from a story by the wonderful writer Grace Paley. I was popular in certain circles, among the river rats and the leaves. For example, I was huge among the lichen, and the waterfall couldn't get enough of me. And the gravestones, I was hugely popular with the gravestones, also with the meat liquefying beneath. I'd say to the carrion birds, I'd say, are you an eagle? I can't see so well. That made us laugh until we were screaming, eagle, imagine. The vultures loved me so much they'd feed me the first morsel from their delicate talons, which is what I called them, such delicate talons. They loved me so deeply they'd visit in pairs, one to feed me, one to cover my eyes with its velvety wings, which were heavy as theater curtains, which I was sure to remark on. Why can't I see what I'm eating, I'd say. And the wings would pull me into the great bird's chest, and I'd feel the nail inside my mouth. What pals I was with the scavengers and the dead things, too. What pals. As for the living, the fox would not be outdone. We'd sit on the cliff's edge and watch the river like a movie, and I'd say, I think last night. And the fox would put his paw on top of mine and say, forget it. It's done. I mean, we had fun. You haven't lived until a fox has whispered something the ferns told him in your one good ear. I mean, truly, you have not lived.
Gabrielle Calvo-Caressi reading from her new collection of poetry. The collection is called Rocket Fantastic. That poem, I Was Popular in Certain Circles. Gabby's a professor of English and poetry, English at UNC, poetry fellow at UNC Chapel Hill as well. What's the inspiration for that poem?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's funny. It feels funny to say this publicly, but that poem I wrote the day, the morning after I hadn't won a big award. I should just admit these things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm a human being who deals with my desires and my wants. And so I went downstairs the next morning and I was, you know, full of a certain kind of disappointment. And I, as I often do on days when I'm sort of thinking about my writing life a lot, I read an interview in the Paris Review. And so I read this wonderful interview with Grace Paley, and she referenced that story, which I knew. And I went downstairs and I started writing the poem. And as poems often do, it completely surprised me. It showed my smallness to myself and also to my grandeur. And also there was a talking fox. So everything turned out awesome.
That's a great moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you realize you thought you were so great and you say, oh, oops, caught me.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about you mentioned, I don't see so well was a line in that poem. You have a condition called nystagmus, I think.
Nystagmus. And so it's a condition. I have genetic congenital nystagmus, so I was born with it. So if we were sitting closer, you would see that my eyes are in constant spasm. A lot of people who have it don't necessarily learn they have it until later. And people think, oh, well, your eyes are shifty. You'll hear people call people shifty. But I was very lucky in that I had I lived in a rural area, but I had a very good eye doctor, and then I had a holistic eye doctor. And so people with nystagmus very often have balance issues reading, all sorts of things. And I got that dealt with. I went to the eye doctor once a week, this holistic eye doctor once a week, from when I was about 7 until I was about 20 years old. But it's a constant part of my life, that kind of fatigue, balance issues, and then this perception thing. What am I looking at? Is it what I think it is? Let me look a little bit closer.
It's hard for you to know. I mean, maybe hard for you to answer this, but do you think having this condition, because you don't know what it would be like to be without it, but do you think in any way that
oh,
helps
sure.
you as a poet?
Yeah, you know? I think it's been, as many of my hardest moments have been, you know, my mother took her life when I was young. The things that were very hard have also been extraordinary gifts to me. Really. And so I can't say it for sure, but I can say that, you know, the fact that I couldn't walk until later in my life, and so I sat around reading books all the time, the fact that I always had to be thinking about what am I seeing, I think that opened me to a whole world that helped me become a better poet.
You are currently, you mentioned your mother's suicide just now, and you're working on a nonfiction book now called The Year I Didn't Kill Myself.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that.
Well, I think that it's interesting talking about this, but I think, you know, one of the things as a child who had a parent commit suicide, I was always being asked, and I continue to be asked, is why did she kill herself, or why do people kill themselves? And as I move through life, it seems to me that maybe the great question is, why doesn't everybody kill themselves? You know, I mean, why? What keeps us going in a world where things can be so hard? And so, instead of sort of blaming her by asking the question, "Why did you do that?" I've been thinking a lot about, gosh, what are the things that keep me going? Mm. And very often, it's the smallest things. You know, I lived in California. Rosemary bushes grew to be like 6 feet tall. I had no idea that could happen. That's a kind of hope, you know? It was beautiful. One of the things this book thinks about is how can people have the kind of access to their own imaginative life that makes grace possible.
Well, it also points to something else that happens in this book, and it happened again in the poem you just read, I Was Popular in Certain Circles. On the one hand, unlearning yourself is critical to figuring out what this is really all about. But then improbable identifications
yes.
can help too. So
Absolutely.
Identifying with the fox and the vulture and the digested meat in the grave, all of those things which we don't do, are they helpful to you? Do you try to imagine kind of what it's like, who else and what else we're connected to?
Absolutely. And one of the ways I've always done that is I always say to students that, you know, poetry, one of the great things about poetry is that daydreaming is a kind of job and profession that you have, right? I mean, it's mixing real critical rigor and learning with being able to imagine multiple worlds for yourself. And in doing that, in imagining, well, what would it be if I lived in this world? What would it be if the fox really could talk to me? Maybe the fox talks to me. But also, what would it be to live in this small town and, you know, like my mother, not have health care and be in this kind of situation? Empathy is a word we use a lot, but I think it's also, you know, it builds a kind of community within the self and an ability to imagine community within the self that then helps us move that out into the world.
Gabby, what a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Gabrielle Calvert-Caressi is an author. Her new poetry fiction is called, she's got a collection of fiction, in fact, called Rocket Fantastic. She's a professor of English and the Walker Percy Fellow in Poetry at UNC Chapel Hill. We've got links to her work at our website, stateofthings.org. By the way, Gabby's going to be reading at New West Hall on campus at UNC Chapel Hill today at 3:30.
Well, it's actually the poet Jennifer Chang. I wanted to give a plug, though, because we're running this series at UNC today. New West Hall at 3:30 p.m. At UNC Chapel Hill. I'll be introducing her, and it'll be a great afternoon of poetry.
North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.